Welcome to Washington in Focus, your source for the week's top stories in the state of Washington. I'm Cole Lauterbach, managing editor for the Center Square Newswire service. This week, we'll be discussing a protest demanding affordable housing in Washington, another protest demanding lawmakers simply do their jobs. Some toll lanes in Washington getting much more expensive on March 1st, and a hearing at the U.S. Capitol over the alleged backroom deals that could mean the end of a number of hydroelectric dams in Washington state. That's ahead on Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach.
Knowledge is power, and you deserve to know what happens in your state government. That's why the nonprofit Franklin News Foundation is bringing you straight news journalism through the Center Square, reporting on state authorities and publishing stories that show where your money goes and who spends it. By supporting the Center Square, you can track politicians' use of taxpayer money and demand transparency from elected officials. This is how we can equip everyday Americans to hold their government accountable. Become a supporter of Franklin today at franklinnews.org/donate.
Welcome back to Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach. Now let's jump into the headlines. We start at the Capitol steps in Olympia, where on Tuesday, activists dressed in red gathered demanding more affordable housing. Of all the ways to accomplish the goal, they're pushing for one of the more controversial. Capitol reporter Carlene Johnson was on the scene Tuesday. Carlene, what were they demanding?
Well, they're demanding caps on rent that have, as anybody who rents a home or rents an apartment, a condo knows, have gone out of control. The desires of the sponsors of House Bill 2114 and Senate Bill 5961 are to cap increases to 5% a year in our state starting in 2025. And in addition, would also prohibit rent and fee increases during the first year that a tenant is there. And if a landlord wants to raise rent by 3% or more, they'd have to provide at least 6 months of notice to the tenant, regardless of expenses the landlord might be incurring during that 6 months. They'd also be able to move out if they couldn't afford the increase without any penalties.
So a lot of these sound like the rules that were in place during the emergency orders during COVID, if I remember correctly. I know that there was in other states, there was a lot of those rules in place and they fought to try and codify them. But a lot of, I know California had a couple that passed, but even in California, as progressive they are, they did not move forward with making a lot of those rules, like the rent increase rule, the percentage increase, permanent. What were some of the consequences of rent control that those opposed to the premise stated?
Well, Morgan Shook with a company called Eco Northwest. They specialize in land use and redevelopment policy. He testified during the hearing and he said, you know, lawmakers, years of experience, they know this, and economic studies, they know this. It's proven that rent control policies will fail. He says, you know, you get the short-term benefit. Of course, the tenant doesn't get priced out of their home, their apartment. But he said the long-term damage is far more consequential. And the real root is the housing shortage. And we know that communities that increase housing supply see prices go down. So it's not an overnight thing, but you know, you go 2-3 years down the line, if supply's there, you know, supply and demand, the prices are going to adjust. But that's when you let the market control it, not government telling people, you know, what they can and cannot price their rentals at.
Right. And you run into a situation where the term is NIMBYs, you know, not in my backyard, where people right. will live in their single family homes in neighborhoods with HOAs that demand that there's no, you know, duplexes, there's no casitas in the backyard to give somebody else a home. Those people that will oppose, they'll support more affordable housing, but just as long as it's not affecting their, you know, white picket fence neighborhood. And what you also see when in places that do have rent control are the unintended consequences of the governmental, you know, regulation, like in, for instance, in New York, where historically rent controlled apartments and locations, residences become exactly. a sort of treasured thing that's passed down via generations, where it's like my grandfather got into a rent controlled apartment in Manhattan and it was passed down, you know, using the same rules to my parents and I'll inherit it one day. And it also then, like you kind of alluded to, is the investment just vanishes because there are no reasons for a landlord, a property owner to improve the rented location, because the person that's renting it under rent control would never give up such a sweet deal no matter what the conditions are in there. So you then have the issue of people being labeled slumlords under these rent controlled premises, because there's simply no reason for them, short of, you know, demands and threats of lawsuits by the tenants, to fix up these apartment complexes.
If they're not able to, you know, increase those rents to keep up with what everything else is costing them, then of course they're not gonna, you know, put in a new refrigerator, even if it's, you know, 15 years old and not working right. So yeah, you said those unintended consequences. So you get housing providers that aren't able to increase rents. Then you get new developers unlikely to come in. I mean, I was looking at some statistics from the National Apartment Association, and they basically said, you know, rent control reduces the amount of property taxes housing providers have to pay. All right. This is because of rent control. So ultimately, governments think they're doing something good, but it ends up reducing the values of the property. And as a result, you get owners paying less property taxes, and the government ultimately then collects less revenue. Since this is not immediately in front of the face, you just don't have the, you know, the tenant that's saying, oh, you know, I was able to stay with, you know, my two kids. I'm a single mom in my home. This is a couple years down the line, but property taxes being as essential as they are for local governments, you got to think about that impact a couple years down the line.
It's interesting, yeah, because it would affect it, because property taxes for a business-owned property are based on not the value of the property like you would if you own the home. If you're just a single homeowner, they're based on the monetary capabilities of the property. In most states, that's the general rule. And by limiting the profitability of a property, you have revenue going down. I mean, that's simple. Simple economics. Another simple law of economics with this is that you have, you know, this is typically Seattle, right? Well, I mean, this would probably be the most prominent in Seattle in terms of where this is the issue, but Seattle's not an island. You're surrounded by suburbs. You're surrounded by places where you can commute. It's not, you know, Hawaii, where, you know, the residents of Maui can't build into the ocean. I wonder how that's going to come up in the conversation as the debate goes on behind this push for rent control. I know that reading up on this one of the two House bill you mentioned appears to have stalled in committee, but I believe the Senate bill is still ongoing and could get a hearing yet. So we will track that as it goes on. Thank you, Carlene, for your coverage on that. Another gathering in Olympia a day later, but this time attendees were looking for something a bit more simple. Crowd gathered at the Capitol demanding lawmakers give the six recently certified ballot initiatives their day in the legislature. Washington editor Brett Davis attended the rally. Brett, why do residents have to drive all the way out to Olympia to pressure lawmakers to do something the state constitution requires them to do anyway?
Right. Well, the basic answer to your question is because that's where the rally was held. But to your larger point,
thank you.
The state constitution says that initiatives to the legislature, and I quote, shall take precedence over all other measures in the legislature except appropriation bills, and shall be either enacted or rejected before the end of the regular session. So they have some constitutional obligations to attend to. So that's what basically the point of the rally yesterday. The overarching theme was, you know, they need to do something about this.
Now, even though these have been highly publicized, there's people that probably still don't know maybe all six initiatives. Could you go over and just give me a, you know, Cliff Notes version of each one?
Of the six, there's one that will loosen restrictions on police pursuits, make that easier to do. Another one would repeal the carbon tax on gas. Another one would establish parental rights in the public schools. One would abolish the capital gains tax. Another one would allow certain people to opt out of the state's long-term care program, WellCares. And finally, the sixth one would ban further efforts to push pass income taxes in Washington state. So we've got quite a bit.
Now, these are all brought about by I got an organization called Let's Go Washington. It's principled by a man named Brian Haywood. He is calling the signature gathering effort the largest of its kind in American history. And after looking in terms of the scope, I can't find anything similar, even in states like California, where the signature requirements due to the population of nearly 40 million people are much higher. How many signatures did they have to round up for all six of these initiatives to be certified with signatures to spare?
Right. They gathered a whopping 2.6 million signatures for these six initiatives. So it's quite the signature gathering machine they have over there. I tried to look up the same information you did, and I didn't find anything equivalent. So he sounds like he could be right.
Yeah, no. I mean, there could be something I'm missing, something that just wasn't as publicized. And maybe there's a federal effort where they had to gather signatures that could have been higher. But I mean, that's not a state-based effort where they're limited to the state boundaries.
Now, I went down to several of the signature turns in Tumwater, and it was just amazing how many signatures they got each time. It was really impressive, actually. I'm not aware of any similar effort.
Now, local unions and other progressive groups are opposing the effort. We've got one organization, one nonprofit there is gathering donations to oppose all six efforts. Could you tell me a little bit about those?
Yeah, in addition to unions, there's also organizations like the Washington State Budget and Policy Center and Invest in Washington Now. I think they're opposed to all the initiatives. So I get a lot of emails when all those initiatives were certified. So yeah, they're not happy about it. And of course, a lot of the Democrats aren't happy about it either. That was a big mention at the rally. Democrats, they don't seem to be interested in actually holding hearings on these initiatives. So Monka Dinger the other day said something to the effect of, if these initiatives pass, it will take Washington back decades.
Well, I mean, it does, you know, some of them are new, would institute certain initiatives, like the one with the parental bill of rights, that would create something new. But several of the others are simply rolling back things that the Democratic majority in Olympia has pushed through. And, you know, a lot of them are Governor Inslee's crown achievements. You look at the...
like the carbon tax.
The carbon tax is something that, you know, is going to end up on his Wikipedia page, whether it survives this or not. I mean, that was, you know, one of his signature achievements. And
same deal with the capital gains tax.
Exactly, right. The capital gains tax as well. Since taxes, income taxes are not allowed in Washington, technically, at this point, at least not yet. And those are looked at as, you know, this outgoing governor's crowning achievements. And if they do get rolled back, I'm going to be interested to see how this is looked at in the history books as a rebuff of a three-term governor's legacy.
Brian Haywood has made similar comments.
Well, it's definitely something we'll keep track of and give you the latest on. Thank you, Brett. Now we head north to the Seattle suburbs, where driving on a couple of well-traveled highways is about to get a lot more costly. Seattle reporter Spencer Pauley explains in his story that the Washington State Transportation Commission has approved toll rate hikes on Interstate 405 express lanes and the State Route 167 high occupancy toll lanes. Spencer, what's a trip up those roads going to cost me next month compared to what are they costing me now?
So drivers currently using I-405 or State Route 167 basically have one more month of rates from 75 cents to $10 or 50 cents to $9. On March 1st, drivers will see the rates jump to a minimum of $1 and a maximum of $15.
So you're looking at a fairly significant increase here in terms of, you know, looking at total drivers and how much more is this toll hike expected to cost everybody that drives these. I've seen a statistic, but it sounds kind of complicated because they're expecting this to change behavior.
Exactly. So it's hard to tell exact estimations for how much this will cost your average driver, because experts were telling the Washington State Transportation Commission that it's hard to gauge how this changes drivers. Some drivers will instead choose to just use the general lanes instead of the high occupancy lanes. But there are some statistics that we can base off of. Currently, they found that average daily toll rates are $2.41 on I-405 and $3.36 on State Route 167. Now, what we'll have to see is how people respond to this tax or this toll rate increase. But one thing we do have is that the toll rates are expected to increase revenues by $1.1 million to $2.5 million. For a total of $4.8 million to $8.3 million in total from the span of March through June 2025. So on a broad spectrum, we're definitely going to see an increase in revenue.
So even with the estimated change in behavior, because this could be something that commuters who have up to this point used those lanes as a convenience and they're willing to pay that amount, they're looking at no longer doing it because they see $15 or, you know, a portion of that depending on how much they use them, and say, this is no longer economical for me and I'm going to not do it. Even with that expected change of behavior, it sounded like you said it's going to double their revenue. Why such an increase now?
Well, the commission says it's increasing toll rates in order to boost funding to address shortfalls for recently awarded corridor projects. And these are used to improve the roads and these lanes on these highways. In turn, this would help kind of ease congestion on these roads during daily commutes. Once statistic I found was that these project bids to improve these roads came in at a whopping $275 million over cost estimates put on by the Washington State Department of Transportation.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what they were looking at is a situation where it wasn't just that, things are just more expensive now. It was, we expect this to cost this much. Then they asked for quotes from outside companies looking to do these RFPs, which is a request for proposals.
Correct.
And they received numbers back that were, like you said, double the cost.
Yes.
for these mandated projects that they were, you know, it's not just some idea that they had. These are oftentimes projects that are voted through the legislature and then they're instructed to do these projects. So beyond just the cost of these tolls, oftentimes with the higher cost of making traveling on roadways more expensive, this doubling of the tax or the toll could make other things more expensive, could it?
Oh, yeah, especially your daily commuters who have to take these roads to get to, you know, Bellevue, where you're seeing a lot of these big tech companies based out of, or Redmond even, like Microsoft is based there. So you could see drivers potentially choose to use alternative routes for their commutes, which in turn could be a little bit longer and lead to more frequent stops at gas pumps. I mean, I believe current average price of gas at statewide is $3.94. A month ago, average was $4.13. And that really adds up depending on what car you use.
And then in the summertime, once gas inevitably goes up because people start traveling more for vacations and such, law of supply and demand, you know, you could definitely see with that added travel onto just a daily commute on a macro level, you could definitely see prices going up from there on.
Right.
Plus, extra roadway travel means extra roadway wear. And that equals out to extra roadway repairs for the Department of Transportation.
Exactly.
You know, that's it's interesting to hear about all of these unintended consequences. Spencer, I appreciate your reporting on this, and we'll keep an eye on it. Moving on, a hearing in Washington, D.C. this week delved into the outcome of an ongoing saga dealing with a settlement regarding the Snake River between the federal government and a group of governments and tribes known as the Six Sovereigns. Eastern Washington reporter Randy Brock covered the marathon hearing. Randy, Republicans who called the hearing are lobbing some heavy allegations about negotiating parties. Could you tell me about those?
That's correct. It has been a saga, and it's ongoing. And on Tuesday in Washington, D.C., the House Subcommittee on Energy, Climate, and Grid Security conducted a five-hour hearing in which congressional members, federal agency officials, and representatives from a variety of interests, utility, farm, barging, Indian tribal nations. They offered often conflicting viewpoints on a federal mediated document called the Columbia Basin Restoration Initiative that was submitted by the Biden administration to a federal court in Oregon last month. This initiative outlines plans by the federal government over the next decade to enhance salmon and steelhead populations in the Columbia River system, including the Snake River in the Pacific Northwest states. The document also calls for financial support to tribal nations for electrical production capability.
Now, what is the big dispute here, though? I mean, this was a five-hour hearing with multiple panels talking about this deal. And what type of, in terms of resolution, did they come to anything?
In terms of resolution, there really wasn't any. And sometimes you kind of wonder if it's just something for different factions to get talking points down the road. But what's in dispute is how to boost salmon numbers and the price tag in doing so. And the bottom line really is this: should this process involve breaching or removing four federal hydroelectric dams on the Lower Snake River in southeast Washington, so that migrating salmon can more easily return from the Pacific Ocean to their spawning habitat in northern Idaho. Basically, the initiatives is the Biden administration's response to a decades-old lawsuit that's pending in U.S. District Court that was initially filed by the state of Oregon and tribal environmental sports fishing interests who want the dams removed. A judge's decision on whether to accept it is still pending.
I did see an argument on line about how there one of the tribes said we have the right to put our nets into the river, but we also have the right to not put our nets into an empty river devoid of fish. And that seems right. to be, you know, kind of the gist of what they are, the argument they're making in terms of that, which leads me to think, I mean, it sounds like the dams could be in question. Randy, who spoke up on Tuesday? What did they say?
Well, these four dams are located in the congressional districts of two Eastern Washington Republicans. Those are U.S. Representatives Kathy McMorris Rogers of Spokane and Dan Newhouse of the Yakima Valley. On Tuesday, Rogers reiterated their repeated concerns that the mediation agreement was worked out behind closed doors with a select group of, in her words, radical environmentalists, and it's going to cost $1 billion or more, even after the federal government has already spent millions of dollars in enhancing dam operations and habitat to improve these salmon runs. Rogers says other factors are at work, and they're outside the region and that have hurt salmon, and those include pollution in the Puget Sound, ocean warming, and sea lion predation. She and other witnesses also insist that the dam removal would literally require an act of Congress. And if this should materialize, the region would suffer severe economic harm, including the loss of electrical production, irrigation for agriculture, recreation, and the ability to barge literally millions of bushels of wheat cheaply and nearly carbon-free along the river corridors to ocean ports.
Right. So much has been made of Washington's baseload power ability in terms of a wind farm might not necessarily be, isn't considered baseload power because it's not always there. And in times of, say, you know, say a cold snap, which has never happened except just once 2 weeks ago, you need that baseload power to make sure people can keep their heat running. So, Randy, who is supporting this initiative and what was their input into this panel?
Well, the Biden administration brokered this agreement between several federal agencies and the states of Washington and Oregon. And I might interject that the state of Idaho is opposed to this, and it has intervened in this lawsuit also. But in terms of supporting it, it's the two states of Washington and Oregon and the four tribes, the Nez Perce, the Umatilla, Warm Springs, and the Yakima tribes. And they're accompanied as plaintiffs in the lawsuit with a coalition of fishing and environmental organizations represented by a nonprofit organization called Earth Justice. On Tuesday, Jeremy Takala, a Fish and Wildlife Committee chair for the Confederate Tribes of the Yakima Nation, said he was concerned that the committee was hearing a one-sided story, quote, fueled by fear and misrepresentation about the Biden administration's December 14 agreement and what it means for the people of the Pacific Northwest. Takala said a study by the Bonneville Power Administration showed there would be little to no impact to electric customers under this agreement and that it would uphold tribal treaty rights with the prospect of restoring sport and commercial fishing industries. And he said shovel-ready jobs with economic benefits.
Randy, thanks for sitting through that marathon session, and we will have more on that as it develops throughout these negotiations. And a big thank you to all of our journalists for sharing their stories. Stay up to date with all of these and more at thecentersquare.com. I'm Cole Lauterbach, and until next time, this has been Washington in Focus.